Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the situation on the ground in Israel getting out of hand with vigilante attacks on Palestinians and Israeli Arabs, including an horrific scene in the town of Bat Yam where Israelis hauled an Arab man out of his car and lynched him. Joining us to discuss the escalating violence between Israel and Hamas and the escalating violence between Israelis and Israeli Arabs is Asher Kaufman, director of the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies and a professor of history and peace studies at Notre Dame, who previously taught at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. We'll discuss how negligent or even deliberately provocative Prime Minister Netanyahu has been in not anticipating the possibility of clashes with the ending of Ramadan coinciding with the Jerusalem Day march by Israeli nationalists, along with rising tensions over the evictions of Palestinian families in East Jerusalem. With Israel in the midst of forming a new coalition government, the current warlike atmosphere plays into Netanyahu's hands, since he wants to cling on to power as long as he can to avoid going to jail. Then we'll look into how much opinion is shifting in this country away from unconditional support for Israel in our politics and in the press, and speak with Mitchell Plitnik, a political analyst and frequent writer on the Middle East and U.S. foreign policy and a former vice president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. He is the co-author with Mark Lamont Hill of the new book, Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics, and he has an article at 972 magazine, Equality is Finally Breaching Washington's Debate on Israel-Palestine. Then finally, we will examine the challenge to American democracy the Trump GOP poses now that Liz Cheney has been purged for telling the truth about Trump's big lie and his responsibility for the attack on the Capitol. Joining us is Amanda Marcotte, a feminist author, blogger, and politics writer at Salon, where her latest article is Democrats Refuse to Take Advantage of the GOP Civil War. Do they care about democracy? And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Asher Kaufman, who's director of the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies and a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and from 2000 to 2004, he was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace and headed its Middle East unit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asher Kaufman.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And it does seem that what's happening on the ground in Israel and in particularly in Gaza, it seems to be spiraling out of control. There are reports coming in and some shocking video of vigilante attacks on Palestinians and Arab Israelis inside of Israel, including images of a man being hauled out of his car and lynched. So do you think that the political authorities, Netanyahu and company, have a grip on this situation? Obviously, passions are running high.
Yeah, you are correct. Passions are running high. And currently, the situation inside Israel proper is really grave because this cycle of violence between Hamas and Israel has actually seeped into Israeli society proper. So these images of vigilantes lynching an Arab have now, they demonstrate really the deterioration of the situation. And they've also been equal images, disturbing images of Arabs doing similar things to Jews in the last few days, and it looks like the government is not able or perhaps not interested in controlling this internal strife inside Israel.
And the government, of course, is in a position of transition. Netanyahu's nominally in charge, but it looks like there's a new coalition government being formed, led by Naftali Bennett, who is even more further to the right than Netanyahu. So what kind of a grip on power does Netanyahu have?
So, I mean, there is no new government yet, obviously. Netanyahu is still the prime minister of Israel. He's in a caretaker government. And some journalists in Israel itself have already named this cycle of violence as the Netanyahu's, war, because it is in his interest, actually, to stay in power, to stay as prime minister. And since he lost the ability to form a government last Friday, he may have now maybe able to use this violence in order to remain in control, because remain in control, or at least lead Israel into another cycle of elections, because it is becoming more and more challenging to form a new government in Israel, given this new cycle of violence, because the possibility of Bennett and Lapid to form a government relied heavily on a partnership with an Arab Islamist party. And that seems to be now a big challenge, because this Arab Islamist party, I don't think, is able to, make a commitment to an alliance with either Bennett or Lapid, given what has been happening in the recent days in Israel and in Gaza.
So to what extent then did Netanyahu, either, I don't know whether it was cynicism or lack of attention, I mean, surely he must have known that these provocative marches through East Jerusalem by settlers and nationalists shouting death to Arabs, and particularly the Israeli police inside the third holiest shrine in Islam, in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, firing, stun grenades, etc., against the Palestinians. That apparently has outraged not just the Hamas, and that's the excuse Hamas is using for launching all these rockets against Israeli citizens and civilians in Tel Aviv and Lod, etc., but the average Palestinians are outraged by this too. So how much did Netanyahu let this thing get out of control earlier? Because, we know that there's a lot of tensions over the case that the Supreme Court had delayed on the settlers wanting to take over and evict a bunch of Palestinian families in the Sheikh Jarrah region of East Jerusalem.
Yeah, I don't know to what extent Netanyahu himself was conniving the whole deterioration of the situation. But there is no question that in the past 2 years, the entire political system in Israel has been taken hostage by Netanyahu's survival struggle to remain in control of the government, to remain stay prime minister, while his trial for corruption is being held. So if there was a functional government in Israel, about 2 months ago, security cabinet should have met together with Netanyahu, looking at the Jewish calendar, looking at the Muslim calendar, and realizing that both calendars are actually converging on a critical time period for Jews and for Muslims. Ramadan and the conclusion of Ramadan on the one hand, and Israel's Memorial Day, Independence Day, and Jerusalem Day, all events that for Jews and Muslims in the country are really important, and Jerusalem plays a really significant role in the national imagination of both communities. So a responsible government would have said, this is really a critical moment that we need to be attentive to, we need to be sensitive to. We have to make sure that we are paying attention to the possibility of escalation. Instead, what Netanyahu did for his own political survival was empowering Kahana affiliates, empowering them, and in fact, facilitating their entrance into the parliament, into the Knesset. So now we have in the Israeli Knesset a party that identifies with really fascist right-wing ideology, and that only that has only elevated the flames in recent days. So it's almost, of course, we have now the hindsight. You know, we see 2020 in hindsight, but there is no question that this current violence serves Netanyahu's political interests, and it feeds on a growing or a process in which there has been growing escalation in terms of rhetoric and verbal violence, and now translated into physical violence against the Arab citizens of Israel. And in the last 2 days, we have seen Arab citizens of Israel, you know, responding and with their own violence against Jewish targets, in particularly in mixed cities in Israel, that have known for decades, you know, policy of neglect of their Arab populations.
And again, I'm speaking with Asher Kaufman, who's director of the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies and a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. And prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And from 2000 to 2005, he was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace and headed its Middle East unit. So you can draw a sort of line, can't you, from what Netanyahu has either willfully neglected or neglected in terms of. And of course, I mentioned earlier the outrage that the Palestinians feel about the Israeli police firing stun grenades inside Al-Aqsa. That happened, right, of course, at the end of Ramadan as well. And you, yes, mentioned clearly you've got this clash of these important holidays, and particularly Jerusalem Day, which celebrates the 67 war recapture of Jerusalem. So this is not surprising. I mean, how much do you think there's these sort of vigilantes, like the ones that lynched the Arab who hauled him out of the car, feel there's a kind of license to kill coming from the government? Or is this just a result of the extreme tensions where you've got rockets raining down indiscriminately on Israeli cities?
You know, the entire discourse in Israel, public discourse in Israel, has become more and more inflammatory. And there is more and more legitimacy to make really outrageous, racist statements against the Arab citizens of the country. That has been led by top political leaders in the country. And in some instances, has also been led by Netanyahu. It's only in the last few months before the last election cycle that all of a sudden Netanyahu remembered that Arabs are, in theory, equal citizens in Israel, and he paid some lip service to their legitimacy and calling them, trying to get the Arab vote in support of him. But there has been now really an escalation in the last few years of really inflammatory rhetoric against the Arab citizens of Israel. And it is not only done by these Kahana affiliates, but by senior members of Likud and other parties in on the right wing of Israeli politics that have been saying so. So I think these vigilantes that we can now see on TV and their actions in the town of Bat Yam are feeling that they are empowered by this kind of rhetoric. It is now legitimate discourse in Israel to make vehement racist statements against Arabs in Israel, coming from the center of the political political parties in Israel.
So do you expect there to be an international backlash to this? And will it have any impact on Netanyahu and Israeli politics?
I think about international backlash, it's a question of how the United States will respond to it. And I try to separate between the internal dynamics that are happening now in Israel and the conflict between Hamas and Israel. I think the international community can respond and should respond to the conflict between Israel and Hamas and force a ceasefire. And this is where there could be and should be pressure on both parties to reach a ceasefire. Internally, I'm not sure that the international community has any capacity to intervene, and it is a really grave internal Israeli matter that is not going to be resolved and perhaps never will anytime soon. In fact, what we see now is that how interconnected everything is in Israel and Palestine, that a conflict involving Hamas in Gaza and the settlers taking over Palestinian house in East Jerusalem is tied to grievances of Palestinian citizens of Israel, and all of these issues are in fact interconnected. From an Israeli, Jewish-Israeli perspective, there's always been an attempt to separate the Palestinian citizens of Israel from the other parts of the conflict. But we have witnessed in the last few days a reminder that, in fact, it is impossible to create this separation. That you have to realize that for Palestinian citizens of Israel, even those that have integrated very well inside Israeli society, and there are hundreds of thousands of them that have integrated really well into Israeli economy, Israeli politics, that have become, you know, have adapted some of you know, the general Israeli cultural habits, if you will. Even for them, at the end of the day, they are Palestinians, and Palestinian grievances from East Jerusalem to Gaza are their grievances as well. So it is a reminder for those of us who thought that somehow you can separate between these communities. If you want to think about it from the perspective of years, you know, how do you address this conflict, from 1967 or from 1948? So these conflicts internally inside Israel now are a reminder to us that you have to think about this conflict as a whole, starting with the 1948 war and the displacement of Palestinians from the country on the whole, and that the Arab citizens of Israel, Palestinian citizens of Israel, are part of this part of the of a problem that needs to be addressed.
Well, Nasha Kaufman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Asha. And again, I've been speaking with Asha Kaufman, who's director of the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies and a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. And prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And from 2000 to 2005, he was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Institute for the Advancement of Peace and headed its Middle East unit. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how much opinion is shifting in this country away from unconditional support for Israel in our politics and in the press. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mitchell Plitnik, who is a political analyst, frequent writer on the Middle East and U.S. foreign policy, and the former vice president at the Foundation for Middle East Peace, the director of the U.S. Office of B'Tselem, and the co-director of Jewish Voices for Peace. He is the co-author with Mark Lamont Hill of the new book, Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. And he has an article at 972 Magazine equality is finally breaching Washington's debate on Israel-Palestine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mitchell Blitnick.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I spoke the other day with Gideon Levy at Haaretz, a columnist who writes the weekly Twilight Zone column on Gaza and the occupied West Bank. And he seemed to think that the leadership in Israel were going to try and calm things down as they are in a transition to get a form a new government. Mm-hmm. But it looks as though things are escalating. And what's your sense? Do you think that this is just going to get out of hand, or are there any ways to stop the escalation?
Well, it's unfortunately, it's going to be very difficult to stop the escalation. I think what Gideon was probably looking at, and I'm certainly not in any way speaking for him, but what he was probably looking at is the fact that the Israeli political leadership probably did not intend this escalation. I think they did not expect the response to their actions in and around Jerusalem that they got from Hamas. But once they did, it presented a certain political avenues for Netanyahu to both delay issues with the recent election, as well as just maintain his, you know, hopefully for him, put build his own constituency up as the tough security guy. So the way that this usually gets turned, you know, the heat here in this situation gets turned down is some combination of diplomacy by the United States and usually Egypt. Egypt has been trying to do that with very little success because the United States really hasn't been involved. And it's difficult to see how much the United States can get involved at this point because they don't even have an ambassador to Israel. They don't have anyone who's a sort of consul or envoy to the Palestinians. They just sent Hadi Amer, the undersecretary of state for the Middle East, over to the region. But Hadi, who I've met a few times and I know is a smart guy and knows what's going on and you know, he's a good envoy, but he just doesn't have the office. He doesn't have the gravitas behind him to really affect anything here. So there's no ambassador and there's no clear direction from the White House. On the one hand, you know, Biden has talked about in general sort of human rights. And then when it comes to this, it's Israel has all right to defend itself. And the fact is that unless Israel removes the massive police presence from Jerusalem, that's what Hamas demanded. And it wasn't an unreasonable demand. If they and back off from their attempts to take over, to allow settlers to take over the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem, it's going to be very, very difficult to use the usual diplomatic maneuvers that could tone down this conflict, at least not until a lot more damage has been done.
So in the past few days, Hamas and Islamic Jihad in Gaza have fired about 500 missiles, and that's actually probably old data. And that some of them have been raining down on Tel Aviv and mostly on Lod. The Israelis have closed their main airport, Ben Gurion International Airport. There have been a number of Israeli casualties. There have been a number of actually Israeli-Arab casualties. There's one tragic story of a father and his daughter were killed by one of these Hamas rockets because they didn't have a bomb shelter in their village that the Israeli government didn't recognize, and meanwhile, right next door, imported Thai laborers were given a bomb shelter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, obviously, Hamas is a pretty nasty organization. Hamas itself in Arabic means zeal, and they're not nice people by any stretch of the imagination. But there is apparently a widespread revulsion and lots of demonstrations from Israeli Arabs who are demonstrating because they feel that the Israeli police actions in the third holiest shrine of Islam, the Al-Aqsa mosques, were absolutely unacceptable, where the Israeli police fired stun grenades inside the mosque. And it seems like, along with the Sheikh Jarrah evictions. This has really set the Palestinians off. And of course, you've also had these marches in Jerusalem on Jerusalem Day and before, where you have these right-wing youths and settlers marching through Arab quarters chanting death to Arabs. So how much do you feel that the Palestinians have been provoked into this situation? You mentioned earlier you didn't think, as Gideon didn't think, that the political authorities wanted this situation and they'd like to calm it down. But it seems like the Netanyahu and company aren't able to restrain their own police and their own settler movement.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that were happening here. I think one is that there was a lot of miscalculation in the Netanyahu government beforehand. That I think to some extent they bought into their own rhetoric about how their own Palestinian citizens, could be essentially bought off to ignore some of the issues of occupation. It turned out that was not the case, especially when it comes to Jerusalem, which is one issue that, certainly Palestinians on all sides of the Green Line and outside the region all, are all feeling pretty strongly about. So the miscalculations, I think, were not only about the Sheikh Jarrah area, but also about the impediments to Palestinian access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque during the month of Ramadan. I think that really set off a lot of ill will for Palestinians, again, on all sides of the Green Line. So I think that was the first miscalculation. The second, as I mentioned earlier, was Hamas's reaction, which they didn't expect. Once that started, though, I think the Netanyahu government probably lost a lot of its incentive to try and tamp any of this down. And they've been adding fuel to the fire ever since, and I think are trying to turn the violence, in a sense, to their own advantage politically. And that has caused obvious escalations throughout the region. And notably, I think the one place that hasn't really seen a lot of violence is the West Bank outside of the Jerusalem area, because the Palestinian Authority has been clamping down to make sure that that doesn't happen. This is not something that Israel tends to want to highlight, especially because rhetorically Netanyahu has aimed a lot of his ire more at the Palestinian Authority over the past couple of years than even than against Hamas. But clearly within Israel, we're seeing Palestinian citizens bearing a lot of the brunt of this. The clashes in Lod, Ramleh, and other mixed, both Palestinian towns and mixed Palestinian Jewish towns, have been very, very ugly. Some of the most violent ones, actually, that we've seen anywhere. So the idea that Palestinians within Israel are somehow disconnected from Palestinians in the occupied territories, I think, was one that a lot of Israeli politicians were trying to sell before and has clearly been proven to be untrue.
And again, I'm speaking with Mitchell Plitnik, who's a political analyst, frequent writer on the Middle East and U.S. foreign policy, and a former vice president at the Foundation for Middle East Peace, the director of the U.S. Office of B'Tselem, and the co-director of Jewish Voices for Peace. He's the co-author with Mark Lamont Hill of the new book, Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. And he has an article at 972 Magazine, Equality is Finally Breaching Washington's Debate on Israel-Palestine. And again, I don't have the latest statistics, Mitchell, but there have been over 150 Israeli airstrikes in Gaza. That was as of Tuesday afternoon. At least 35 deaths. A lot of children were killed. And it is obviously getting worse as we speak. And you mentioned in terms of your article at 972 Magazine about equality is finally reaching Washington's debate. The White House, in fact, Jen Psaki, the press secretary, in being questioned about it yesterday, was saying that U.S. officials, meaning White House, Biden perhaps, and others, have spoken candidly with Israeli officials about the eviction of Palestinians from East Jerusalem. And then she went on to say, "We believe Palestinians and Israelis deserve equal measures of freedom, security, dignity, and prosperity." That sounds pretty new to me. I don't think I've seen any American president and their White House speak in such even-handed ways. Have you?
I would actually, I would actually differ with that a bit. The rhetoric is a little bit more even-handed. It's reflective, I think, of the Biden administration's attempts that are not going very well right now to deprioritize Israel-Palestine and to sort of extricate itself from, or at least keep a certain distance from the conflict as a political issue. But I mean, the reality is, in the end, it's policy. It's a lot less about what is said and a lot more about what is done. So one, I think, major issue, if we do just want to look at statements, we can look at the way Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, has been talking about this, and he has been repeating the usual American talking points about Israel's right to defend itself, and it, which of course it has, and Israel's right to security, which of course it has, but not talking about in contrast to Jen Psaki, not talking about Palestinian right to defend themselves or Palestinians' right to security. And you know, I think this is where the problem comes in, because in the end, no matter how we try to take this apart, the United States is Israel's ally and a very strong one. And they are staunchly standing by their ally. And in the, you know, they have talked about how Hamas must stop the rocket fire, and certainly the indiscriminate rocket fire aimed at civilian targets is unacceptable. It's illegal under international law. But Israel is also, for its part, they intentionally targeted a residential apartment building. That is a unambiguous an unambiguous war crime, and one that Israel made no bones about committing. And when we consider the fact that Hamas's weapons and their armaments, they are limited in how much they can even control them, whereas Israel can decide what targets it wants to hit. You know, this certainly would call for the United States to tell Israel, "Hey, pull back. Don't be, you know, don't be blowing up apartment buildings." Dozens and dozens of families were made homeless in that attack. So that reflects the same old double standard, even though this administration may look a lot more liberal, I guess, than certainly than the previous one. But in the end, you know, they're not doing anything to hold Israel back. While as the exchange of fire goes on, they are being heavily critical of the Palestinians.
But how much are they hampered by having to undo a lot of what Trump did, with particularly with Pompeo's declaration that Israeli settlements are not inconsistent with international law, Trump's ludicrous deal of the century plan, reopening the PLO mission in Washington, reestablishing U.S. consulates, etc., funding UNRWA, which Biden has done to some degree. I mean, obviously Biden's got a lot on his plate. The last thing he needs is foreign policy nightmares, which this one is now starting to look like. And of course, you've got an election transition in Israel. My understanding from what Gideon was telling me a couple of days ago was that it looks like Naftali Bennett might form a government, and he's just so much further to the right than even Netanyahu. It's a frightening prospect.
Yeah, he is. On the other hand, Bennett, if he does form a government, would also be dependent on more centrist or at least center-right parties than Netanyahu is. So it's kind of six of one, half a dozen of the other on what that would mean in terms of policy. And you're right that Biden, you know, certainly has a lot to undo with regards to the things that Trump did. Thing is that Biden has already said he's not going to undo some of them. He's not going to reverse Trump's decision to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He's not going to reverse Trump's declaration of U.S. recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital. And when we talk about reopening the PLO mission in Washington, that's actually something I think Biden does intend to do, but it's tricky because of various U.S. laws. That really what Trump did was simply allowed them to be triggered. And once they're triggered, they're much harder to undo. So there is all of that. That being said, you know, the situation we're in right now could have been diffused much earlier had there been at least a U.S. ambassador to Israel, who could have been in constant contact with the Netanyahu government, and telling them not to escalate matters in Jerusalem. I mean, we need to go back and consider that a lot of this stems from the confrontations at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, where Israeli forces opened fire, injuring hundreds of people in Jerusalem, in the mosque itself. And that was a severe provocation, one that was building for several days, and the United States did and said nothing about it, in part because there was no one there to actually meet with the Israeli government and say, hey, back off of this, which we have seen American presidents from, by the way, from both parties do in the past. So that is a product of, again, of Biden's desire to deprioritize this, to not invest political capital in this. It's something that's been tried by other presidents. It never works, because unless you're willing to actually change U.S. policy towards one where we really aren't supporting Israel's occupation, then the sort of benign neglect that Biden was trying actually turns into even more myopic support for the occupation.
So, Mitchell, I was going to ask you, why did you write the book? I mean, in as much as it's always been so one-sided, and, you know, it's difficult to be an advocate for the Palestinians because they do seem to be in many ways their own worst enemies, particularly with the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas. You know, they have an election coming up. The Fatah wing is so fractured with corruption and infighting. They keep losing to Hamas, which is a pretty hardline organization, to say the least. So, you know, is there any way for the Palestinians to get their act together? I think the young Palestinians are completely fed up, aren't they, with the Abbas government?
Yeah, so there actually isn't an election coming up because Abbas canceled them.
Right.
And I think it's important to note that in doing so, he was given the green light by the Biden administration to do that, which really sort of throws into question. And the reason was fairly obvious. The stated reason was that Israel was making it difficult for residents of Jerusalem to participate in the Palestinian elections. This was actually kind of a ruse. Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, Israel, and the United States all did not want these elections to happen, precisely for the reasons you said. Fatah is a mess. They are corrupt. They are seen as human rights abusers. The younger generation of Palestinians have really lost faith in them. And one of the results is that the party itself is splintered. And much like in 2006, multiple candidates were running as Fatah in a number of races for the Legislative Council. So no one wanted, knowing that Abbas could actually lose the presidential election and was a pretty good chance, in fact, I would say a very good chance, that Fatah was going to lose the legislative elections again, as they did in 2006. No one wanted those elections to take place. Abbas publicly stated that unless Israel gave unimpeded access to voters in Jerusalem, they would cancel the election. So therefore, Israel followed suit with the blessings of the United States. So, you know, this comes back to why did Mark and I write this book? Because here we have the Biden administration, which has, I would have to say, surprising me in many regards, certainly with domestic policy, in terms of what they've done to bring some progressive policies to bear in their first few months. And I think that's terrific. But when it comes to foreign policy, they've been much weaker. And when it comes to this issue, as has always been the case, they've been a disaster. That's why we wrote the book, because even liberal administrations, liberal voters tend to not be so liberal when it comes to the Israel-Palestine conflict and when it comes to the question of Palestinian rights. So we wanted to show how that is actually working and hold a mirror up to people and say, this is how you're behaving. This is how U.S. policy and policies that liberal Americans have supported match up against ostensible liberal values. And it just doesn't fit.
So is there a way then to champion the Palestinians on human rights grounds and on moral grounds, even if they are sort of politically rife with self-sabotage? Mm-hmm.
I think absolutely. In the same sense, I mean, yeah, if we look at it from the 40,000 feet in the air view, we can look at the United States and say, were Americans entitled to respect for their civil and human rights, even though we elected Donald Trump and everything that he did? I think the answer is yes. We can absolutely look to supporting the Palestinians' basic rights. And there are ways that those rights can be expressed. And indeed, it was precisely, when we talk about the Palestinians, quote unquote, getting their act together, it was precisely them potentially bringing in more dedicated leaders, less corrupt leaders, more capable leaders, perhaps, that scared the United States, Israel, and certainly the Palestinian Authority. So I think supporting the expression of freedom that the Palestinian people themselves are constantly making, are constantly striving for, that's absolutely something we can do. And again, if the Palestinians, if we opened the space for the Palestinians to achieve their own liberation, then we've done our part. That's what our job is. Whether or not the Palestinians can then, get their own act together to do that, that's up to them. But our part is to open the door up and especially to get our government out of the way of achieving that and to make the United States not a major obstacle, ideally to actually make U.S. policy turn it around into something that facilitates Palestinian freedom and Palestinian rights, but at the very least make it, stop it from being such a gigantic obstacle.
So just in the last minute then, what would your invocation be to our audience and why they need to get your book?
I think it is important to understand the arguments and to also see how U.S. policy under both very conservative and more liberal administrations have all served to reinforce an American, a bad American policy with regard to this conflict, a policy that not only inhibits the achievement of Palestinian rights, but also inhibits a future for Israelis that is more secure and more peaceful.
Well, Mitchell Plitnik, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me in.
And again, I've been speaking with Mitchell Plitnik, who's a political analyst, frequent writer on the Middle East and U.S. foreign policy, and a former vice president at the Foundation for Middle East Peace, and the director of the U.S. Office of B'Tselem, and the co-director of the Jewish Voices for Peace. He's the co-author with Mark Lamont Hill of the new book, Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics, and he has an article at 972 Magazine, Equality is Finally Breaching Washington's Debate on Israel-Palestine. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the challenge to American democracy the Trump GOP poses and how much the Democrats are prepared to make an issue out of it. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Amanda Marcotte, who's a feminist author, blogger, and a politics writer for Salon. She's the author of Troll Nation, How the Right Wing Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Effing Liberals, America, and Truth Itself. And her latest article at Salon is Democrats Refuse to Take Advantage of the GOP Civil War. Do they care about democracy? Welcome to Background Briefing, Amanda Marcotte.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And on Tuesday night, Liz Cheney made a very powerful speech in the House. And of course, what happened was that all of her Republican colleagues, they just were slinking out of the place quietly because they couldn't face the fact that she was speaking truth to these cowards and bootlickers who have this supine fealty to this monstrous fraud, Trump. So it just feels like we're at this extraordinary moment where as you point out in your article, you know, and as Lynn Cheney's talking about, that you know, American democracy is on trial and it's facing its biggest test probably. And yet I don't see the Democrats, and you certainly don't see them, rallying to this issue. I mean, this, I guess Biden's got so much on his plate, but it would seem to me that this would be the number one priority to fight for democracy at home and abroad.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, all other things being equal, that Biden and Pelosi and Schumer, Chuck Schumer, would agree with you. It's just that they don't have the votes right now to pass legislation that would stop the Republican war on democracy. So they're letting their legislative priorities be sculpted by what they have votes for. And so that's the infrastructure bill. And that's kind of traditional politics, right? You get that low hanging fruit, get yourself some victories. And, you know, the harder stuff, if you get around to it, good. If you don't, oh well. But the current situation is such a hair on fire emergency that those sort of traditional political calculations are ill-advised at best.
So your article, of course, focuses on Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. And I'm not sure about what makes these two tick, really. And it is a bit mysterious. But the one thing that I've heard about Manchin is that he would like to be able to peel off a Republican. Just one, it would be enough to put the fig leaf of bipartisanship, and then he might come aboard the idea of getting rid of the filibuster or modifying it or making... He actually made a statement a while back that he was in favor of the standing filibuster, the Mr. Smith comes to Washington type of filibuster. So is it possible that out of this Cheney situation, maybe, do you think any Republicans are going to defect in the Senate?
No. I think what we have seen is that a couple of Republicans have made lackluster defenses of Cheney, but by and large, I think the main result of what's going to, the main result of what happened to Liz Cheney is going to be that every Republican now realizes if they do anything more than make a couple of lame arguments in defense of democracy, they're also going to get thrown out of the party. So the very notion that you can chip off a Republican vote, when we've seen with our own eyes what happens to any Republican who does even the slightest defense of democracy, is that they lose all their power and all their position and everything, is beyond ridiculous. You know, Joe Manchin is living in a fantasy land if he thinks that's possible.
Well, there was, of course, on Tuesday, a Senate meeting, a kind of face-off, I guess, between the Democrats and the Republicans, with Chuck Schumer on one side of the table and Mitch McConnell on the other, where they were trying to come to some kind of agreement on the parameters of SB1, which is the Senate version of HR1. Which is the means by which you could end all of this, or do an end run around all of this Republican voter suppression and you can't do anything about gerrymandering, but you can certainly do something about what's happening. And it goes deeper into dark money and other aspects of our broken democracy. Of course, McConnell says this whole thing is a Democratic power grab. There was some suggestions on the part of Democrats that there were areas of compromise. Do you see anything coming out of that?
No. I mean, whenever, I think it's the rule of thumb, not even rule of thumb, I mean, the standard thing to understand with Republicans is if they negotiate, say they're going to negotiate, take a meeting, do anything of that nature, all they're doing is trying to run out the clock. They have no intention ever voting for anything a Democrat puts up. If they pretend that they are going to vote for it, that is merely an opportunity for them to just take a bunch of meetings and kick the vote down the road so that it never gets scheduled. It's just running out the clock. So if Democrats give them meetings and let them waste their time, it just is further evidence that Democrats are failing to understand the seriousness of this moment, because there is no such thing as a concession that would actually get Republican votes on board, because the whole point of this is to make sure that nothing that Democrats want to get done gets through the legislation.
Which is exactly what Mitch McConnell said recently.
I mean, yeah. He doesn't even hide it. He pretends to their face he's up for negotiations, and he turns around and tells the right-wing press that he would never, ever allow a vote on anything.
Yeah. Again, I'm speaking with Amanda Marcotte, who's a feminist author, blogger, and politics writer for Salon. She's the author of Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Effing Liberals, American Truth Itself. And her latest article at Salon is Democrats Refuse to Take Advantage of the GOP Civil War. Do they care about democracy? Now, curiously enough, Matthew Dowd, a Republican strategist who was behind the successful re-election campaign of George W. Bush's in 2004 and the successful election campaign of Arnold Schwarzenegger out here for governor of California, he's been railing mostly on MSNBC, saying that Biden's top first priority should be the defense of democracy itself and to rally the American people about what the Republicans are doing now. Because it's not out of the question that they could win and take the House and Senate back in 2022 and the White House in 2024. So there, and he's arguing that defending American democracy and saving it from this sort of fascist onslaught by the Republicans and this vengeful ex-president, who they're all sort of stepping in line behind, also resonates abroad, because you have people like Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin who are telling the world that democracy doesn't work and their kind of authoritarian governments are much more effective and efficient. So it's a broader struggle, both in terms of the outside world and the situation here at home. So can Biden really rally the American people around this? I mean, you've got 100 or so Republicans now coming out on Thursday with apparently some kind of plan to form a third party of kind of the Republicans that we used to know, our fathers and grandfathers Republicans. Is there anything to work with there?
I mean, maybe, maybe not. But I think that the main thing here is that you have to try, because the only other option is to just roll over and let them terminate our democracy as we know it. And so it could fail for sure, but it will fail if you try. It definitely could fail. I mean, the number of Republicans who are willing to defect to the pro-democracy side is pretty small. You know, 100 doesn't mean 100 congressional Republicans. That's like 100 people who've been Republican leaders in the past, most of whom are former officials, right? But if you don't try, you absolutely will fail. And at this point, to fail means to just basically give up democracy and to give up any hope of Democrats having anything resembling power again, because that's what Republicans are trying to do. They're trying to enshrine permanent minority rule, and they are getting real close, real close. I mean, it's sort of uncharted territory for sure. We don't know for a fact how effective these laws they're passing in places like Georgia and Florida are going to be in terms of forcing, in terms of making sure that voters don't get to the polls, and making sure that if they do vote, that their votes don't get counted. But I have to say, when you look at some of these laws, it's pretty serious. It's pretty serious what we're looking at, especially in terms of Republicans have moved, organized around Trump's insistence that local election officials should be able to just throw out votes on the merest whiff of an accusation of fraud from Republicans. And that's a pretty scary thought, but that's kind of where they're heading right now.
Well, in effect, they're getting two bites at the apple. The first go around is they suppress the vote with all kinds of
sort of Jim Crow-like tactics. And then the second bite of the apple is that once the votes are in, the Republican partisans get to count and certify the votes. And we see what's happening now in Arizona with that farce going on. So the idea of these kind of people counting the votes is that's the end of democracy. So I don't know whether the ludicrous nature of what's happening in Arizona is resonating. At least some of the Republican senators who voted for this farce are now having second thoughts. Is there a name and shame possibility here? I just don't know how much this resonates as the key issue that it is. It is the most important issue of all, but it may not really be resonating with the public in the way that maybe some pocketbook issues do. Is there a way, do you think, to break through? I mean, the idea that we're having it, you know, that Liz Cheney is now our champion of democracy, given her background in ultra-conservative politics, is kind of sad, really, that the Democrats aren't rising to the occasion.
I mean, in a sense, it doesn't matter if the public rallies, because if laws to stop the Republicans from doing what they're doing on a state level, if they don't pass the For the People Act and other legislation to keep Republicans from stealing elections, it's not going to matter what the public thinks after this. It doesn't matter if the public likes an infrastructure bill, if the public isn't allowed to vote. And like, this is the end of caring what the public thinks. That's the whole point of what the Republicans are doing. They know that the public doesn't like them. They know that they can't win free and fair elections, so they're trying to stop them from happening. And so if the concern is, well, if the public thinks, then we need to have a future where that continues to be important. And it's just a very odd, I recognize that this is like difficult for politicians who spent their entire life kind of thinking about what the public wants and trying to do that and trying to be popular. But popularity doesn't matter if there's no way for it to affect the final results at the ballot box.
But if you go to a casino in Las Vegas and there's a big sign in front of the casino saying this casino is rigged, would you go into the casino? It is rigged, and by the way, we know that the house always wins. But I'm trying to give an analogy of how and what kind of idiots we are to accept a situation, because it's so clear that the Republicans do not want to compete. They want to cheat. And that is their path to power. And they've given up on trying to broaden their base. And that is just as clear as day. And the idea that they're following this dreadful fraud is beyond belief. And this man who is responsible for inciting the attack on American democracy, the worst attack on this country since 1814, it's just amazing that there are so few voices speaking out. But again, I'm just thinking in terms of all this effort to go to vote, and yet it's so clear that it's not a level playing field. And the only way to overcome that, I imagine, is a massive turnout. Is that the only card the Democrats get to play? A massive turnout in 2022? And that goes against tradition.
I mean, that was the card that the Democrats had to play in 2020. If they don't pass H.R. 1, I don't know that they even have that card anymore. Because, again, the problem is, in Georgia at least, they've passed a law saying that the state legislature has the right to throw out the elections board of any district that they want and replace it with their own people. So turnout can be massive, but, you know, I live in Philadelphia, and, you know, we had that situation here where Trump just put this huge pressure campaign on the state legislature to basically take all the votes of Philadelphia and just throw them in the trash. And he wasn't able to get that done because the law wouldn't allow it, but their Republicans are changing the law in some of these states so that can in fact happen next time. And so I think we'd be looking at a situation where even massive turnout and very clear wins with huge margins may not be enough. And, you know, this is how it goes in some place like Russia, right? And that's clearly what Trump was imagining for himself, and he just never amassed the kind of political change during his time in office to make that happen for him. But now he's kind of created a template for what he imagines that would look like, and the Republicans are falling in line with that. And so I do think most Democrats on Capitol Hill understand the seriousness of the situation, which is why the For the People Act was H.R. 1, the first bill that was brought in front of the House. It's just they don't have enough votes unless a handful of centrists like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema get on board. And there just doesn't seem to be any evidence that they're moving in the right direction.
Well, just in closing, of course, today, Wednesday, President Biden is meeting with the leaders of the House and Senate, the four, Schumer, Pelosi, McConnell, and McCarthy. And then Thursday, Biden meets with six Republicans. So I imagine Biden's in touch with Manchin, isn't he? I mean, obviously, it's not a good idea to go after the guy, because all he has to do is decide to walk across the aisle and it's all over. So I guess you got to be nice to this guy. At the same time, what kind of persuasion is going to work on him and Sinema?
I mean, I wish I had an answer to that. I feel like Joe Biden would know better than me because he actually knows them. And yeah, he's been in contact with them. And he gave Joe Manchin's wife a job and seems to be doing all the stuff that you need to do in order to grease the wheels here. And yet they've just gotten more stubborn. And I mean, this may be a situation where there isn't a solution. I mean, I certainly don't have it.
Well, American democracy hangs in the balance. If SB1, well, HR1's already passed, but if SB1 can't be passed, because you're never going to get 10 Republicans. And by the way, the seventh most liberal Republican in the Senate is Mitch McConnell. So go figure. I thank you for joining us, Amanda.
Thank you for having me. I'm sorry it couldn't be a happier interview.
Oh, well, reality bites, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And again, I've been speaking with Amanda Marcotte, who's a feminist author, blogger, and politics writer for Salon. She's the author of Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Effing Liberals, America, and Truth Itself. And her latest article at Salon is Democrats Refuse to Take Advantage of the GOP Civil War. Do they care about democracy? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. And this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.